From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, filling in for Terry Gross. It's springtime. By now, the flowers in your garden, if you have one, have probably bloomed, and the lawn is just about to get out of hand. It's time to reacquaint yourself with the mower. Today on Fresh Air, a look at our relationship to the lawn and what it says about us with writer Michael Pollan. Also, we meet French-Chinese actress France Nguyen. She played the Vietnamese doctor on the television series Saint Elsewhere and starred in the Broadway production of The World of Suzy Wong. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews R.E.M.'s new release, Out of Time. That and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Özal of Turkey has given a warning that neither United Nations guarantees nor the agreement between Saddam Hussein and Kurdish leaders will be enough to persuade Kurdish refugees to go home to Iraq. As Jonathan Rugman reports from Ankara, President Özal's statement may upset those Western leaders hoping to hand over responsibility for the refugees to United Nations forces.
Mr. Özal said that it would only take strong military power to persuade the Iraqi refugees to go home, and that if Allied forces didn't continue their presence in Iraq, then the Kurds would turn back when they saw their first Iraqi soldier. Mr. Özal added that if the United Nations and other countries failed to solve the problem, then it was up to Turkey and Iran to do something about it. The Turkish president was speaking to the Iranian news agency just before the arrival in Turkey of the Iranian president, Mr. Ali Akbar Rafsanjani. Both Turkey and Iran have been forced to accept thousands of refugees along their borders. Turkey has problems with its own Kurdish minority and feels that both it and Iran should have a say in how the refugee crisis is solved. For National Public Radio, this is Jonathan Rugman in Ankara.
The leader of the Russian Federation, Boris Yeltsin, has begun a visit to the Siberian coal fields to try to persuade miners to end their two-month strike. During a speech, he said that President Gorbachev made several concessions in the joint declaration signed last week with Republican leaders. The BBC's Tim Huell has this report.
The miners' strike, with its demand for President Gorbachev's resignation, has strengthened Boris Yeltsin's hand in his struggle with the Kremlin and enabled him to win emergency powers as Russian leader. But now he's under pressure to prove that he can succeed where Mr. Gorbachev failed by bringing the dispute to an end. At the same time, many of the miners are becoming dispirited after 8 weeks without pay and would welcome an honorable return to work. The most likely formula will put the mines under the control of the Russian Republic and give them the right to sell part of their production on the free market. What's angered some miners is a mention in the joint declaration of plans for a special regime in key industries. But Mr. Yeltsin insisted in Novokuznetsk that implied incentives to work harder, and he warned that if Mr. Gorbachev attempted to go back on the agreement, the republics would simply leave him out in the cold and sign a new union treaty between themselves.
The BBC's Tim Huell. The process of disarmament in Lebanon appears to be moving forward. The country's main Christian militia said today it will give up its heavy weapons in accordance with the Arab League peace plan to end the civil war. The announcement comes just 24 hours before the deadline for Christian and Muslim militias to hand over their weapons. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 35 points today to close at 2,876.98. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court voted today to reduce the access to free appeals for poor people. The vote to change the court's procedural rules was 6-3. The majority said the court is burdened by frivolous appeals from people who qualify as paupers. Dissenters said the change will give rise to the perception of unequal justice for the rich and the poor. As it is now, people who qualify as paupers can file appeals without having to pay a $300 filing fee and printing costs. Under the new rules, the court would be able to take that privilege away from people it believes are abusing it. The strike by state workers in Montana entered its fifth day today, with some 5,000 state workers staying off the job. Jim Robbins reports from Helena.
As state workers walked picket lines in front of the Capitol, legislators inside were working frantically to come up with a solution before the session ends at 8 Tuesday morning. The legislature and Governor Stan Stevens, a Republican, remained deadlocked over the issue of increased pay and benefits for state employees, who are among the lowest paid in the country. About $2 million out of the state's total budget of $900 million separates the two sides. After negotiations broke down this afternoon, Democratic leaders who control both the House and Senate said they will pass their version of the pay bill and send it to the governor. If the governor vetoes the bill, legislators will be forced to return for a special session. It is not clear whether employees will go back to work or stay out on strike. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Robbins in Helena, Montana.
A study released today indicates that a large number of the consumer credit reports on file in the U.S. today are inaccurate. The Consumers Union found that 48% of the reports it studied contained at least one mistake. Almost a fifth contained a major error that could hurt a consumer's chances of getting credit. The reports that were studied came from the country's three major credit reporting companies. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. In his very first garden, hidden away in a cave of forsythia bushes, Michael Pollan planted a watermelon seed. A few months later, before the green football-shaped fruit had even ripened, he snatched it from the vine and ran to the house to show his mother. But he stumbled. He dropped it on the ground and watched it splatter into useless pink pieces. Pollan has been planting melons, setting trees, ripping up lawns, and contemplating American dreams of nature ever since. He's put many of his thoughts into a new book called Second Nature, A Gardener's Education. Welcome to Fresh Air. Michael Pollan, you say that real gardening begins when you rip up the grass, pull out all those decorative shrubs and bushes and that show your house off to passing drivers, and then secede from the great national lawn.
Yeah, I think that there's a real contradiction between lawns and gardens. And I've been waging, I guess, a sort of one-man campaign against the American lawn, which, though it's as American as apple pie, I think really symbolizes just about everything that's wrong with our attitudes toward nature and the landscape. And
well, what is a lawn?
Well, a lawn, specifically I'm talking about a front lawn. I don't have anything particular against grass, per se. But Americans beginning in the, I guess it was in the second half of the 19th century, were encouraged to take down our fences and hedges, plant a lawn, and since there were no fences and hedges, they would all run together and create this impression that we were all living together in this park. And so we just rolled this carpet of lawn across the country, and there is a lawn that runs from the White House into every one of our yards. There is a very strong convention that we all abide by in our front lawns, and anybody who steps out and tries to do something else will very quickly find himself to be a pariah in his community.
Well, you talk about lawn mowing as though it were a sacrament, a kind of crypto-religious experience, even a sacrament about the denial of death.
Yes. Well, I think first you have to start with the notion that for Americans, nature is sacred in a certain way. This was the promised land. The Puritans came over here because this was a fresh start, and we had this clean slate, and the American geography or landscape is really what defines us as a people. It's what we have in common. You know, we're every different possible race and religion, and we don't have an ethnic commonality. We don't have a racial commonality. We have this land. And I think that that is one of the reasons that conformity with regard to how we treat the land is so important in this country. So basically, we have elevated the lawn to be this ritual, and it's this weekly thing. It happens every Saturday or Sunday, and it is a sacrament. And by mowing the lawn, we participate in this national ritual of consensus. And anybody who doesn't is a heretic.
Well, of course, if you mow the lawn, then it doesn't go to seed, and by definition, it doesn't die.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, think about lawn. I mean, we take lawns for granted in this country, but they are absurd. They're completely absurd. Here is this monoculture, a habitat filled with a single specimen. There's nothing else like that in nature. One specimen for acres around. Then we take this one specimen and we refuse to ever let it get any longer than basically our pinkies, an inch and a half, 2 inches. We never let this plant set seed. We never let it die. It's a denial of sex. It's a denial of death. It's a complete absurdity. And we love this stuff. Now, I am the first to admit that there's something very attractive about lawns. There is a very sensual feel to a freshly cut lawn. They're wonderful to play in as a child. They feel great on bare feet. But that's one thing, and ostracizing people who violate the conventions is quite another.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Michael Pollan, author of a new book called Second Nature. You know, it seems to me that a lot of the environmentalists and the ecologists, self-described, see it pretty much the same way, though, don't they? I mean, there's this sense of here there is pristine nature, and if only we could get back to it and lose all of these trappings of the city, wouldn't we be all clean and pure
right.
and restored again?
Well, you might think that that's where I was coming from, and in fact, and that I was a naturalist, and I wanted everybody to let meadows grow. But in fact, I've got a beef with them, too. I mean, I think that we in America have a very either-or approach to nature. I mean, in fact, to a lot of things. We tend to see things in absolute terms, in all black or all white. On the one side, when we think about nature, we think about dominance. And the lawn is dominance. Paving a road is dominance. Putting in, tract housing is dominance. And then on the other, we think of complete passivity, acquiescence. If you think about it, America's two great contributions to the what we could call the art of landscape is, on one side, the front lawn. Other countries don't have these. This custom of uniting as many lawns on the other side of the street without any fences or hedges so they all run together, that is an American invention. According to Ann Layton, a famous historian of gardens, our single contribution to world garden design. Kind of pathetic, if you ask me. And on the other hand...
Not too promising, no.
No. And on the other hand, we have this other great contribution to world culture, and that is the idea of a wilderness park. Before John Muir and the generation of people who persuaded Americans to put aside Yellowstone and Yosemite came along, there was no such thing as an area that you drew a line around, threw away the key, and said, people will not develop this ever. That is a great contribution. It's also not a garden. So it's very interesting that the same people would have come up with these two ideas, these two inventions, if you will, because they are inventions, with regard to nature. And they really bespeak our attitudes on both sides. Acquiescence is on the one hand, or domination. Now, there is something in the middle. And in fact, I think what we need here right now, and a big part of our environmental predicament, has to do with getting past this either-or thinking. What is in the middle? Well, what we need right now is a way to use nature, because we cannot help but use nature. I mean, people aren't going to go away. And
people are, after all, creatures.
We are creatures, exactly. Well, we are part of nature. We have a very ambiguous role. We're sort of part of nature, and we stand outside of nature in a certain way also. But we need something in the middle. We need a way to use nature without damaging it. And for my money, the best model of that is something called a garden. That is exactly what happens in a garden.
My guest is Michael Pollan. He's the author of a new book about gardens and dreams and faith. It's called Second Nature. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Pollan is my guest. He's a gardener and an editor at Harper's Magazine and a writer. And he doesn't like lawns very much, at least not out front. What is a weed?
Well, that's a very interesting question. That's a little like asking, what is the nature of evil? The debate in gardens and in gardening circles in philosophy is a weed a defect of our perception? This is what Ralph Waldo Emerson said. He said, a weed is simply a plant that we haven't figured out a use for. In other words, our perceptions decide, and one man's weed can be another man's beautiful flower. On the other hand, is the idea that a weed is a very special kind of plant. It's a plant that is particularly vigorous and aggressive and competes successfully against cultivated plants. And these are really the two poles. It's sort of like the idea, is evil a property of the universe, or is it something that men invented by their presence here? Now, where do I come down? Well, again, I started very naively. I started with the Emersonian, which is a classic American attitude, that a weed was a defect in my perception, and I planted a garden in which I tried to get along with weeds, and I had this laissez-faire, you know, live and let live attitude toward them. And then, of course, they took advantage of this. They just seemed much tougher. They just seemed much more adept at the whole business of being a plant. You know, there are weeds that can travel a foot a day. Kudzu can move that fast. There are weeds that emit poisons that kill every plant around them. There are weeds that can put out 400,000 seeds. A mullein can do that. These are super plants, or they seem to be, to the gardener. And
then maybe weeds are winners and vegetables are losers.
Well, in a sense that they are. In a sense, they are evolution's champs. But one of the things I learned about them, and for me this was a breakthrough, is that weeds do very well. If you look in a field guide and you're looking up wildflowers, the field guide, and you look at where it has, you know, habitats, favorite habitats of this plant, it'll say things like gardens, lawns, waste places. Weeds don't grow everywhere. They grow in disturbed soil. So that, for me, was a very important insight, because what that tells us is that the weed is not, in fact, a super plant. It's a plant that is adapted to grow in the land that we have disturbed. In other words, weeds follow us around, and you do not find a weed like bindweed, which is a big weed in my garden. You will not find it in the forest, and you won't find it in the prairie. Weeds grow where we are and hardly any place else. In fact, you could argue, I mean, if the proper definition of a weed is a plant that grows in areas disturbed by man, you could make the case, and I'm not the first person to have done this, that we are weeds. And in fact, that's what the title of my chapter is called, Weeds Are Us. Very important sense, we are this kind of being. We're great cosmopolitans. We travel very well. We adapt. We change the earth to suit ourselves. And weeds do all these things. So they're the bane of existence, but in fact, they're not natural, as a lot of us think, as Emerson seemed to think, and Thoreau. They always said that weeds had this higher claim to the earth because they grew naturally, and in fact, they don't. They without people, there would be no weeds.
Well, one of the mental processes in the history of American gardens that you and other people have spoken about is our attitude toward art and the garden. I'm thinking of a conversation I had not too long ago with the great Brazilian landscape architect, Roberto Burle Marx.
Yes.
And Burle Marx says that every great garden is that it has to be a work of art. And it's not only a work of art, but it's a work of art that changes every minute of the day and every decade of the century. It never stands still. But Americans have trouble with the idea of the garden as art.
We do. I mean, Americans, I'm sorry to say this, but Americans are not the best gardeners in the world, and very few people ever look to Americans for advice about gardening. As I said, the only kind of gardens that we export to the rest of the world are golf courses, which, of course, are just big lawns. And our golf courses are beautiful, but and the reason I don't think that we have become good gardeners, although I would argue that this is about to change or is in the process of changing, I think we're getting much better at it. And we will invent great gardens in this country. But it does remain one corner of our culture where we're dependent on the British.
Well, what's this problem with art, though? I mean, are we suspicious of art in something that's supposed to be so sort of clean and natural?
Yes, I think we are. I mean, it goes back to this idea I mentioned earlier, which is that we see nature as sacred. And this goes right through American history, right back through to the Puritans. And once you decide that nature is holy in some way, fooling around with it, altering it in some way, becomes a very strange and possibly sacrilegious idea. The Puritans were not great gardeners. We would garden, but we always made a point, and you read these early accounts of gardening, we were doing it for moral uplift, or we were doing it because we needed the drugs that a plant would provide, but never strictly for beauty. The Shakers, you know, would grew beautiful roses, and but they would cut roses with such short stems that no one could ever wear them or do anything with them except make rose water. The idea of taking any kind of sensual pleasure from nature is a taboo in this country, or was until very early in this century.
Pleasure is a problem in our culture at large, I think.
Absolutely.
It?
I mean, all these attitudes definitely go back to the Puritans. And we have this very blunt
opposition of nature and culture, dominance or acquiescence, and these kind of dualities that I was talking about, I think we can lay the blame at the feet of the Puritans. But you cannot make great gardens until you develop another way of thinking about nature and culture as something that can be merged. And they can. They can be merged beautifully. They can be merged in a way that doesn't offend nature and doesn't offend culture. Gardening is a wonderful, very important activity, and there many of us do it in this country, and we don't stop to think about exactly what we're doing. But learning good ways to work with nature and make it satisfy our desires and aspirations and material and spiritual needs is a wonderful process, and it's nothing for people to feel strange or funny about. And I think that it's one of the great things we do. All I've done, you know, with this book is try to point out some of these connections and just let people understand that there's almost another sacrament and it's a much healthier one than mowing your lawn, and that is this transaction with the earth, this process of harmonizing or blending in some way our art and nature's nature, and these things needn't contradict one another. And many other cultures have known this. Shakespeare talks about this quite a bit, there's a great scene in which a character is given a hybrid flower and she rejects it and she says, "This isn't natural." And I think it's Polixenes, it's in The Winter's Tale, says, "You don't understand, but the hybridist art is an art that is nature because we are nature. And what we do is natural. And when humanity comes into a landscape and changes it, that is indeed part of, it's a natural process. You know, beavers make dams. We make walls and hedges and fences. Now, we make a lot of things that are very bad, and I wouldn't argue that everything we do is necessarily natural. I think things we've done for a long time and done successfully without doing a lot of damage are as natural as anything that beavers do or any other animal. And we should feel better about our participation in nature.
My guest is Michael Pollan. He's the author of a new book called Second Nature, A Gardener's Education. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Larry King usually holds court each weeknight for an hour on the cable news network, interviewing newsmakers and celebrities while taking calls from viewers. Television critic David Bean Cooley tells us that tonight cable viewers can get a double dose of King. CNN's sister station, TNT, is presenting the premiere of Larry King TNT Extra.
There's only one chair tonight, folks. Only one mic. There are no phones and definitely no suspenders. This is different. For tonight's special, I met my guests on their own terms and on their own turf. Stay tuned.
That's what Larry King has to say about his first primetime star-studded special. Here's what I have to say about it. Boring. Basically, this is King's attempt to muscle in on Barbara Walters' territory, visiting celebrities at their homes or on the golf course. And he's done something I wouldn't have believed possible. He actually makes Walters look good. It's even possible to make a direct comparison, because one of King's guests on this special, actor Jeremy Irons, was also featured on Walter's pre-Academy Awards show. The main difference between the two interviewers isn't their style, it's their differing opinions about the value of pre-interview research. Walter's relies heavily on her production staff to research and pre-interview each guest, so she comes to the interview heavily armed with information. In addition, each interview is preceded by a short profile of the guest, so that viewers learn a lot about them before the interview even begins. Larry King's style, on the other hand, is to approach each interview the way he would a stranger on a train. Hi, how are you? What have you been doing lately? Tell me a little about yourself. King actually prides himself on not preparing for interviews, saying it makes his conversations more genuine and unstructured. A lot of people have bought that excuse, too, but to me, it's just a lazy way out. There's always an obvious difference between an interviewer who's prepared and one who's coasting. How would you like it if Ted Koppel, for example, began an interview by saying, "Gee, I haven't followed your politics, but that sure is a nice suit. So how are you? What have you been doing lately? Tell me a little about yourself." King's approach works best when he's talking to people who usually don't talk about themselves. He did some really good work interviewing politicians, journalists, and military officials during the Gulf War, for example, and his softball approach brings out some interesting comments from such hardball guests as Frank Sinatra. But when King is dealing with someone who's done a few talk shows, it's usually a waste of time, and the callers ask most of the good questions. In Larry King TNT Extra, King asks Jeremy Irons one good question, then makes another good move by following it up.
Mel Torme told me once that he thought he'd be a drummer, and he heard Buddy Rich play drums, and he decided he would play drums for fun, but he would not be a serious drummer because he could never play drums like that.
Right.
Have you ever seen acting where you've seen someone do
all
something?
All the time.
Could never do that.
All the time. I go to the theater, I see a great performance, I think, well, there's an actor for you. Back to the plumbing, Jeremy.
Really?
Always. And I think that's actually a fairly common thing. I mean, if you see someone really doing it well, either on film or on...
Have you seen a film recently where you would say, I couldn't do that?
I saw Dan Day-Lewis do my left foot. I thought, I couldn't do that.
But with King's other guests, the conversations are almost a total waste of time. We learn that basketball player David Robinson is happy most of the time, that Barbara Hershey is happy a lot, and that James Woods is really happy right now. When your big question is, how are you? That's the kind of information you get.
David Beard Cooley is television critic for The New York Post. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, sitting in for Terry Gross.
As a French-Chinese actress, France Nguyen has played a number of Asian roles, including the Vietnamese doctor in St. Elsewhere on television, Susie Wong on Broadway, and the young Polynesian girl Liat in the film version of South Pacific. Coming up, France Nguyen tells us how acting helped her to discover her own Asian background. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Out of Time, the new release by the group REM. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Allied forces are demanding that Iraqi Kurdish guerrillas stop extorting money from Kurdish refugees and allow them to go home. Since Allied forces entered northern Iraq, some of the Kurdish guerrillas, known as the Peshmerga, have blocked the refugees' return out of fear for their safety. Others have used the opportunity to charge tolls, stopping the refugees at checkpoints and demanding payment for passing through. President Bush today said he was reassured that Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev survived a political challenge last week. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Speaking before an audience of farm writers at the White House today, Mr. Bush was asked about extending more agricultural credits to Moscow. The president indicated his desire to do so, but he expressed regret that the Soviet Union has not implemented market reforms that will make it credit worthy. Mr. Bush also said he has elected to stay in close contact with Gorbachev, saying he is the man there.
What happened last week, I think in a sense, was quite reassuring, because there were some widespread speculation that Mr. Gorbachev was in trouble, even with the party. And I think that showed that that was not the case.
There is a lot of turmoil in the Soviet Union, said Mr. Bush, adding, "We don't take joy in that at all." I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
A powerful earthquake shook the mountains of Soviet Georgia today, smashing houses into rubble and killing up to 40 people. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
According to some reports, today's earthquake measured 7 on the open-ended Richter scale, making it more powerful than the tremor that shook neighboring Armenia in 1988. At least 25,000 people died in the Armenian disaster. Today's earthquake was followed by a second weaker tremor that rattled windows in Tbilisi, the capital of the Soviet Republic of Georgia. Most of the damage appeared to be in smaller Georgian towns, some of which are in isolated mountain regions. Officials at the Georgian government representation in Moscow said some towns were almost totally destroyed. They said information was difficult to verify because the earthquake destroyed communications connections. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The presidents of 6 Yugoslavian republics failed to resolve serious differences on how to hold referendums on the country's future political shape today. A plan designed to prevent Yugoslavia from plunging into civil war is now in jeopardy. The planned setback comes on the second day of a standoff between local police in Croatia and government troops. Independent-minded Croatia, led by a nationalist government, wants to see Yugoslavia transformed into a loose confederation of republics. Marxist-governed Serbia, along with the military, wants to preserve the country as a socialist federation. On Wall Street today, the Dow lost 35 points to close at 2876. This is NPR. The State Department says the U.S. will release $7 million in frozen humanitarian aid to the Cambodian non-communist resistance. The sum is part of a $20 million aid package that was to be disbursed at the beginning of the fiscal year 1991, which began last October 1st. It wasn't handed out because Congress charged that the resistance group had been cooperating militarily with the Khmer Rouge in violation of American law. Israel has reopened a Palestinian university in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Hebron University is one of 5 West Bank universities that have been closed since the beginning of the Palestinian uprising 3.5 years ago. 2 of the universities were recently reopened, and today the closure order against the third was lifted. 2 other universities, An-Najah in Nablus and Bir Zeit, are still closed, although the Defense Ministry says they may be reopened if Hebron University stays quiet. Israeli authorities charge the universities are centers of violent activity and close them. The closure order caused international criticism, and reopening the universities was one of the confidence-building measures U.S. Secretary of State James Baker has asked Israel to take. Meanwhile, Birzeit University professor Sari Nusseibeh was released from jail yesterday after 3 months. Nusseibeh was charged with passing information on Iraqi Scud missile attacks to Iraqi intelligence. He denied the charges. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Delegates at a conference on Antarctica took another step toward banning mining on that continent. A treaty governing the management of the landmass could include a comprehensive conservation package ending mining there. The U.S. and Great Britain have sought to keep open the possibility of mining, while France and Australia have opposed the idea. The deadlock has held up progress on other environmental issues. A compromise text will prohibit mining on the continent for the next 50 years. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. At 19, France Nguyen found herself splashed across the cover of Life magazine, America's newest sex kitten star in Broadway's World of Susie Wong, the first Asian-American actress to hit the big time. 30 years later, France Nguyen has accumulated a long list of film and TV credits since her stage debut as a Chinese prostitute. For a while, she left film to work with teenage gang members and even trained to become a licensed psychotherapist. Then she came back to acting as the Vietnamese surgeon Dr. Kim in TV's Saint Elsewhere. Now she's starring in the film China Cry. France Nguyen began her life in the slums of Marseille during World War II.
I lived in an occupied city, which is my hometown, and we were very much at the brunt of the Gestapo's harassment, and I've seen what happened to the people who were of ethnic background, the Jewish people and the Gypsies and the North Africans and everyone who was there that seems to be not blue-eyed was suspicious. My mother was several times harassed by the Gestapo. She was a baptized Catholic, and so she, had her little paper that says, you know, I am not Jewish. But she had a physical look that could have been Semitic. My grandmother
was Chinese.
No, yeah. My mother is French. No, there was no Asian. We were abandoned from before my birth and. And so I did not really come in contact with the Asian world until I came to the United States.
Not at all?
Not at all. No, I mean, there were people from, I think they were people from Vietnam that had restaurants in my hometown and things like that. But I was never part of it because I didn't have a father and I didn't have someone to connect me with those people. I was connected with gypsies and I was connected with Italian and I was connected with North African people. And these were my people and the French people. All my Asian culture came when I came to the United States, and I made a supreme effort, since I was playing part of Asians, to educate myself both in history and philosophy and so forth. And I got very much involved in the 60s about the history of the black people in America. I imagine because of my youth of hardship with my mother, I knew what it was to be a minority, even though we were French, or my mother at least was pure French, or looked pure French. We were persecuted simply because we were poor, and my mother was a single mother, and in those days that was not very well seen.
You know, I think the first film I ever saw was South Pacific. And probably
the first film you ever saw?
Yes.
As you must have been a little boy?
That's right, in Lexington, Kentucky.
In Lexington, Kentucky. Oh, my goodness gracious.
And I remember, and I think as I look back and I try to remember scenes from films, it is the one in which you and the actor John Kerr, I believe.
John Carr.
Were doing this water dance beneath the surface.
Mm.
And I suppose what I remember about that film is that it was It was a musical comedy, but it was also a film in some ways about prejudice.
Oh, yes. It was the first film that openly spoke about prejudice and sang about prejudice. Do you remember? It has to be drowned in your dear little ears.
And that's, do you remember?
You've got to be taught.
Yes. Do you remember your feelings about the content of that scene and of that show at that time?
Well, my English was zero at the time. And I can only say that later on, it made sense. I think it was, it's probably one of the most honest lyrics of coming from the guts level of, you know, wonderful people like Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein. Well,
how did you get the part in that film?
I came to the United States thinking I could be a model because that's what I had been in my home country. And, of course, in those days, you know, short brown models were not in style. And, but I went to an agency called the Kennedy Jones Canova Agency. It was a very famous blonde, gorgeous model in her days. And she had an agency, and they took some pictures of me. And they said, we'll call you. And, of course, I never called until I was working in my little French bakery there and on Lexington Avenue, the Dumas Bakery. I hope the owner may be still listening if he's of this world. I was working there, and I got a phone call from the Canova agency saying, would you come for an interview? They came and picked me up in a big car, and they brought me to Madison Avenue and got me in a big elevator. And I got into that big office, and there were those three big people there whom I had no clue who they were at the time, Richard Rodgers, Oscar Hammerstein, and Joshua Logan. And this, you know, those gentlemen wants to make a movie. And thank God Joshua Logan spoke French and said, we want to make...
You still spoke no English, right?
I spoke no English at all. And that's why we're working in the French bakery. And they asked me to smile. They asked me to run around the room, and turn my profile one way or the other. And they looked at me, and I walked out with a 7 years contract with 20th Century Fox, and that was my Cinderella story. And Joshua Logan was very sweet and always spoke French to me and gave me direction, and we had a marvelous. A cameraman who used to scare me to death called Leon Shamroy, and who used to bark at me. He couldn't talk to me, so to scare me, he would bark at me. I would shriek and run and be scared, and it was awful. But all those wonderful people took, you know, brilliant photography and made me into an actress, which I had no idea how to be. And Candy Jones Canova packed me off from Hollywood with 3 weeks of Berlitz English. And that's how I got to California.
My guest is Frances Nguyen, an actress who has who first became famous in this country in the movie South Pacific and then later in Susie Wong, and is now in a new movie, China Cry. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frances Nguyen. In a magazine article, it was in Life magazine back in the late 50s, there's a description of you. That was the one when you were on the cover. let me read it to you. It says, she is a cheerful, bubbly 18-year-old who, having come to New York and worked in a cookie shop, applied for a job as a model and instead was signed up by the movies. The photographer, Ornitz, photographed her hands, her feet, eyes, nose, and chin, and found in each an element of grace. Adding them all together, they made a creature with the gay and delicate charm that Occidental moviegoers like to see in their Oriental heroines. How do you feel about that notion? What Occidental moviegoers like to see in their Oriental heroines?
Well, I became the object of let's put it that way. I put dimension and brought to life some of their fantasies.
You are a woman who has held these sorts of roles. How have you seen the roles change? The actual experience of working in the film industry.
I think there's a long way to go, but I was privileged and happily so to be given a most wonderful role in the person of Paulette Kiem in Saint Elsewhere, the television series for NBC. And for
what drew you to that? What brought you back into the industry through a television series?
Oh, I've always done television. I've always done television. I've always been looking for something to do in television or film. I just don't have that much work offered to me, but I had just finished my 6 years of college, and the next week I got an invitation to go interview for that part, and it turned out to be probably one of the most rewarding role I have ever had. It was typically what you would say is non-stereotype, humorous, strong, powerful, a woman who could hold her own, a woman who could fight the not only prejudice, but the main chauvinist Pryor's chief of surgery, who was magnificently played by Bill Daniel. And he was always talking about my kimono, and I was always just like fuming out of the side of my mouth at him, and I had that for 3 years, and I enjoyed it, but it doesn't mean that I cannot play another Susie Wong, and I would not play another Susie Wong. I am not embarrassed or ashamed for whatever Susie Wong represented. She was a wonderful, wonderful, warm, delightful whore. I'm going to get all my female friends very, very unhappy that I pronounced that word. But the point is that she had a dimension as a mother, as a lover, as a lower class, absolutely dirt poor, starving, surviving female, and she fought with everything that she could. And if it took a little bit of the romantic of an Englishman idea of what a prostitute was in Hong Kong, so what?
My guest has been Frans Nguyen, who is in the current film, China Cry. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made, and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us from All Things Considered. What's on the show today, Robert?
Well, we'll be hearing today about the earthquake in Soviet Georgia and also news from northern Iraq, where it now seems that the Kurdish political leaders have told their guerrillas, the Peshmerga, to let the Kurds return to their towns. It had seemed for a while they were preventing the refugees from going back to the cities. We'll hear about that situation and other issues about the Middle East after the war with one of Egypt's leading diplomats, and a report on the intelligence failures that contributed to the war. Also, Mike Schuster's second report on the future of Europe, the prospects for a common European defense.
Thanks, Robert. Those and other stories on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The rock band REM has been recording for about 10 years, and up until 3 years ago, they had put out about an album a year. So, after their first recording hiatus, we now have the new Out of Time. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. From it, Radio Song.
Y'all turn to that station.
The world is collapsing. Around our ears, I turned up the radio. I can't hear it. When I got to the house and I called you out, I could tell she had been crying, crying. It's that same sing song.
REM has been recording for more than a decade now, and I don't think I've ever reviewed one of their records on this show. That's partly because to do so would have been succumbing to the inevitable. If ever there was a rock band made for public radio, it's REM. This quartet from Athens, Georgia, makes the sort of rock and roll that college students of all ages can get into. It's thoughtful music full of jangly guitars, moody atmospherics, propulsive tempos, and, until a couple of years ago at least, lyrics mumbled and swallowed so assiduously that you just knew they had to be profound. Well, REM recently put out its first album to attract something less than universal critical praise, and it's this former cult band's first album to crack the top five. In short, this new record, called Out of Time, is the one that has made REM unhip with rock's tastemakers, but a mass audience favorite. No wonder I think it's their most interesting record ever.
It's bigger than you, and you are not me. The lengths that I will go to, the distance in your eyes. Oh no, I've said too much. I set it up. That's me in the corner.
That's Losing My Religion, the first single from Out of Time. Both the album and song title imply a certain crisis of secular faith that REM has apparently undergone. They've announced that they're not going to tour to promote the album, a real surprise for a band that made much of its reputation on the road. Except for videos on MTV and a recent Saturday Night Live appearance in which lead singer Michael Stipe swallowed his lyrics while dressed in a suit made of Federal Express delivery bags, REM is keeping a low profile. The group is letting the record stand on its own merit, letting it stand, in effect, out of time, out of context from the rest of their work. That's good, because there's a diffidence and a reserve about this music that sets it apart from anything they've done before. That instrumental wouldn't be out of place if it was played over the credits of an episode of 30-something. This music is very different in tone from, say, the REM song you really can hear on television every week. Chris Elliott uses their tune Stand as his theme song for his sitcom Get a Life. At first, a lot of the music on Out of Time seems melancholy and aimless, but very quickly it takes on a subtle urgency. Even on a song such as Shiny Happy People, which features vocal assistance from Kate Pearson of the B-52s, an expression of cheerfulness has a kind of desperation as if REM thinks that happiness doesn't last very long. REM is important in the history of rock for being the first post-punk American underground band to broaden its appeal slowly and steadily, to sustain a career without repeating itself or burning out or turning into a grim little joke. After a decade, REM's music, which initially sounded so insular, so self-conscious, so willing to settle for cult status, has become better, braver stuff. Generous, open, and willing to be shared by people who don't look exactly as if they could be members of REM. That's what pop music is all about.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, Ron Barron, and Richard Parker. Roberta Chirac directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Frank Browning.
I sat there looking ugly at me. Knew what you were saying, you were saying to me. Baby's got some new rules, baby said she's had it with me. Seems a shame to waste your time on me. Seems a lot to waste your time for me. Left me to love what it's doing to me. There's a lot of honey this world, baby, this honey's for me. Got to do what you do, do it with me. It seems a shame to waste your time for me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former New York Times correspondent Gloria Emerson talks about the time she spent living in the Gaza Strip during the Intifada. I'm Frank Browning, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.